From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. What was it like to be in charge of the macho paramilitary Black Panther Party and to be a woman? On today's Fresh Air, we meet the former head of the Black Panthers, Elaine Brown. Also, we talk with Dr. Jerome Groopman about working with AIDS patients at Deaconess Hospital in Boston, where he runs an innovative program of both treatment and research. And TV critic David Bianculli previews Homicide, the new cop show directed by Barry Levinson, who also directed the films Rain Man, Diner, and Good Morning Vietnam. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Senate Republicans said today that they'll go ahead with an effort to reinforce the existing ban on homosexuals in the military if President Clinton presses ahead with his attempt to lift the ban. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
We will not wait if the president does not wait. If the president's going ahead, we're going ahead. That's what South Carolina Republican Strom Thurmond said today on Capitol Hill. Republicans threatened to block family leave legislation that was expected to hit the Senate floor for passage this week. They would block it by amending it with language to codify the existing ban on homosexuals in the military, preempting President Clinton's executive order lifting the ban. Republicans are also pressing for a series of hearings, although many say privately they'd rather be working on an economic package. We didn't ask for this, Senate Minority Leader Dole said today. President Clinton forced the issue, and we have to respond. I'm Elizabeth Arnold on Capitol Hill.
Israel's highest court ruled today that the government of Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin acted legally when it expelled more than 400 Palestinians from the occupied territories. The Israeli Supreme Court rejected all appeals of the expulsions, but it ordered the government to allow the exiles to appear individually before military appeal committees. Palestinian officials said the court ruling threatens the Mideast peace process. They called on the United Nations to impose sanctions on Israel to enforce UN demands that the exiles be allowed to return. The exiled Palestinians have been stranded for 6 weeks in a no-man's land between territory controlled by Israel and the Lebanese government. Israel accused the men of being tied to Muslim terrorist groups. The economy expanded at a 3.8% annualized rate in the last 3 months of 1992. That's stronger than most economists had expected for the fourth quarter. NPR's John Idstey reports.
Much of the stronger-than-expected growth came in the housing construction industry, and consumers did their part, giving retailers their best Christmas season in many years. Economists are skeptical that the pace of growth can be sustained, however. Consumers borrowed for much of the spending in the fourth quarter, and with stagnant job and income growth, they may be unwilling to spend at the same rate for long. The 3.8% growth estimate for the final quarter of 1992 may yet be revised, but for now, it's the best growth since the last 3 months of Ronald Reagan's presidency. Overall growth in 1992 was 2.1%, the best year since 1989. But job growth in the economy remains dismal, and recent announcements of big layoffs at Boeing, McDonnell Douglas, IBM, and Sears suggest a rocky road ahead for many workers. I'm John Idstey in Washington.
On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 15 points to close at 3,306. Advances edged declines in heavy trading. This is NPR. The French ambassador to Zaire was killed today by a stray bullet as Zairean soldiers rioted in the capital city. The French Foreign Ministry said that Ambassador Philippe Bernard was killed by a bullet fired through his office window. The 61-year-old diplomat had been posted in Zaire in December. Belgian officials said that the soldiers were angry because they were being paid in hyperinflated banknotes. Chrysler is reporting a dramatic turnaround in its financial performance for 1992. The automaker earned $723 million last year. That compares to a loss of nearly $800 million the year before. Don Gagne reports from Detroit.
Chrysler's earnings for the year exceeded expectations. At the start of the year, many thought it possible that the number three automaker would have to merge with another company, perhaps one from Japan. Now it's likely that Chrysler will be the only big three U.S. car company to actually report a profit for 1992. Ford and General Motors will release their annual financial reports in the coming weeks. Chrysler Chairman Robert Eaton credits his company's ongoing cost-cutting efforts with the turnaround. At the same time, he expresses some frustration at the slow pace of the economic recovery in the U.S. Chrysler's most successful product remains its minivan, which continues to dominate its market segment despite increased competition from foreign and domestic automakers. For National Public Radio, this is Don Gagne in Detroit.
Oil prices surged on world markets today after two U.S. senators proposed a plan to tax imported oil whenever its price drops below $25 a barrel. World oil prices are now hovering around $17 a barrel. The bill was introduced by Senators Bennett Johnston of Louisiana and Robert Krueger of Texas. They said the variable fee on imported oil would be whatever the difference is between the world price and the proposed ceiling of $25 a barrel. The senators said their plan would raise about $50 billion by the year 2000. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In 1974, Huey Newton, the head of the Black Panther Party, went underground to escape charges of assault and murder. In a controversial move, he handed the leadership over to Elaine Brown. Brown has just written a memoir about what it was like to lead a macho, male-dominated revolutionary outfit. She had worked with the Panthers since 1968. The Panthers were a black militant armed organization founded in the 60s. The FBI virtually declared war on the Panthers. Some members were killed during police raids. Many of the party's leaders were arrested. Brown has lived in France for the past 3 years, but she's visiting the States to discuss her new book. Today I spoke with her in Philadelphia, the city where she spent her childhood. I asked if the men in the Panthers resisted taking orders from a woman.
The party was a paramilitary structure. And so people were pretty much willing to take orders as orders came and not question them. So in order to get around that, there would be side comments. And I mentioned in the book that one man came up to me and said that he could not call women by a derogatory term anymore. Was that true? Imagine that he was addressing this to me, a woman, but he hadn't really realized that he was, because I was the leader. But he's talking about these day-to-day women in his mind. And I had had to issue an actual order as to the internal discipline that men could not call women the B word anymore, among other things.
How would you describe the Panthers to someone who either didn't know the group or didn't understand it?
And there has been a lot of misunderstanding for those who have even heard the name. I don't want to start with a negative, but just generally, we were not a racist organization, and that's very important. That is to say, we were not anti-white. As a matter of fact, we considered ourselves to be internationalists, and that the struggle that we were waging or that we wanted to trigger embraced the concerns and the problems of not only black people, but of poor white people, of Asian people and women and whatever. That was our overall base of people. As to our ideology, we considered ourselves to be a revolutionary in the sense of the elimination of the system of capitalism, and specifically in America, the dismantling of the government and the whole capitalist scheme. This was the big, broad statement, all of which was to encourage people to take a look at the disparities in a very concrete way and to begin to move to eliminate those disparities.
Well, you had control over all the guns and money in the party. How much of each was there?
The money was, at the time that Huey left, I calculated, as I indicated in the book, as I looked at the bank accounts, there was about $1 million sitting around. But there was many millions of dollars in property. As far as the guns, I indicate the kinds of guns that we had. And I would say that, you know, we had into the many thousands of guns.
To understand what the Panthers meant to you personally, I want to go back to your childhood.
Yes.
And find out a little bit about what it was like for you when you were growing up. You grew up in North Philadelphia. You live with your mother and your grandmother. You grew up on welfare.
No, I didn't.
I thought you were on welfare.
We never, except my mother specifically said it was called relief in those days.
Yeah.
And my mother, who was a factory presser, never ever accepted relief money because she considered herself to be above that. And she used to say to me, I'd rather starve and steal or steal than beg.
Now, you were a very bright student, so you went to a special school. The school was predominantly white.
Yes.
What impact did it have on you to go to this school, to be introduced to a very middle-class world, among other things?
Pretty much almost, well, in my mind, it was almost upper middle class, because you had children coming from, in those days, Bala Cynwyd and from Cheltenham and so forth.
Yeah,
so
these are suburbs.
Yeah, of Philadelphia, because it was not a local school or a neighborhood school. Mm-hmm. It was this experimental school. Well, the impact was very easy. I mean, once I got to know the children there, naturally they became my playmates. And I can recall, as I do recall, that the initial thing came with a birthday party, or Halloween party, rather, that I went to one of the girls, a classmate's house, and the first thing that struck me was that she had so many lights in her house, that the house wasn't lit up with 25-watt bulbs, and it was bright, and that there was carpeting there, and that there was, later I learned, I saw another friend's house in which there was a refrigerator, and these things came to symbolize not so much luxury, but this well-being, this other life that I had I didn't know that people only had, I thought everyone lived like me, because one only knows one's own world when you're young. But now I know that there is this other world, and I wanted to enter that other world with everything in me and leave the old world.
And that meant you trying to be white in a way?
Not even in a way. It really meant being white. I mean, it was the most difficult part of this book for me to write, was to admit and to acknowledge that I did want to be white. Not so much to be white. It was not so much difficult to admit that I wanted to be white, but to admit that I did not want to be black. That I hated myself so much, and I hated, therefore, my people so much, at least from the extension of that, that I actually dreamed to be white. Not even in color, but to live like white people. And therefore, I had to become like white people.
You moved to Los Angeles.
Yes.
When, I guess, what is it, after high school?
Well, a couple of years after. I was 22.
And you ended up being a waitress at the Pink Pussycat in L.A. What kind of place was that? And tell us what you had to wear as a waitress.
It was so ostentatious and flashy and cheap. It's incredible to think about. But it was making a lot of headlines, because Johnny Carson at the time was... who had just moved his show from New York to Los Angeles, found this name and just thought it was absolutely hilarious. And so he didn't miss a night when he didn't invoke something about, well, I was down at the Pink Pussycat. So it sort of gained a sort of status that it didn't have in terms intrinsically. I mean, it was an incredibly gauche and ugly, tacky place to be. On the other hand, there was a lot of money being thrown around there. It was a strip club. But not, I mean, it was not a nude show. It was a strip club with the old strippers with tassels on their breasts and, you know, doing bumps and grinds and this kind of stuff right out of Gypsy Rose, you know. And the girls and those of us who were the waitresses, and we were certainly the girls, we wore a Merry Widow bra for a top, which we stuffed the cups of. With paper or whatever. Some people use socks or whatever to give us an extraordinary, pardon me, bosom line, and very, very high heel shoes. And there was a certain glamour to that job, because it was hard to get that job, because these girls were making a lot of money.
Glamour. You went to a party at Frank Sinatra's house.
Yes, ultimately I did. Well, not ultimately. 2 weeks after I had started working there, because of this Johnny Carson stuff, a lot of movie stars were coming there. It was at least that year's thing to do, if not that month's thing to do. And everybody would come in, and everybody was excited, and Sinatra came in with an entourage. And after the first show, there were two shows, and introduced me to Sinatra, and whereupon I was invited to a party at his house.
Now, while you were working at the Pink Pussycat, you met someone named Jay Kennedy.
Yes, through Sinatra. Actually, he was part of the Sinatra party that night.
And he was a writer?
At that time, he was a writer, yes.
And also a businessman?
Actually, he had been a union organizer. Jay Kennedy had been so many different things, but this I learned through bits and pieces. At the time, I considered that he was a writer.
Now, what's really interesting to me about your relationship with him is he was a white man, an older white man.
And as it turns out, he was Jewish, but I didn't know that until about 5 years ago.
But he's the one who kind of introduced you to black consciousness.
Amazingly, isn't it?
How did he do it?
Well, he started out by the very first night we had dinner, he invited me to dinner. And I was sort of thrilled. I mean, this was a whole world of, you know, money and power that I had sort of stepped into quite by accident. So I was fascinated by him. I didn't think of his age one way or the other. As a matter of fact, that was very comforting for a person who'd never had a father or never really had a relationship with a father. And he began talking to me about the March on Washington, because you realize this was, 65. So the March on Washington had been 63. So this is pretty much, the civil rights movement was very much on the minds and on the and in the mouths of everybody in the country. And so he asked me if I'd been in the March on Washington, and I thought, well, what does this have to do? No, I haven't been to the March on Washington, about, you know, my people trying to gain their civil rights. And I had no idea what people he was talking about. I was so confused in my not black, not white world. And he began to talk to me about that, and eventually Stokely Carmichael and the sort of rise of this sort of SNCC and moving into the black power, call for black power. And he was talking about the whole business of social conditions in America and actually in the world. And then beginning to tell me about communism versus capitalism, or socialism versus capitalism, all of which lived in the abstract in my mind, but nevertheless it was being pounded home into my brain pretty much every day, because he was very much of an activist in the civil rights movement, and he was very much a believer in a change in America. So yes, here I am, a black woman being educated by a 55-year-old white man about social conditions in America.
The real paradox is when you really, the deeper you got into thinking about black consciousness and civil rights, the more you had to leave him in a way.
Well, because, I had to. And he recognized that, as I indicate, he wrote a book later called The Chairman. Well, you've been writing that book. And when I received a copy of the book later, it was incredible to see the chapter about the white male protagonist suddenly having a black female girlfriend who goes off and becomes a black militant.
What appealed to you about being a militant that the civil rights movement didn't have for you?
Personally, despite all of my notions about being white or not being white, I did come from my roots, my base, my character has all been formed and based upon my relationship with North Philadelphia. I mean, I was a girl of the streets. I knew how to walk the streets and act on the streets. And so the streets, meaning urban America, urban black America, where after the Great Migration, most blacks ended up being, as I think of it, stuffed into these areas or cordoned off, if you will, into these areas, almost like in internment camps. And so my style and my character was already that. And to see an attack dog on a black person, and who was just saying, "Yes, we shall overcome." Well, this had nothing to do. I had an automatic response to somebody who was aggressive with me, and it wasn't to sing any songs. So that, and many black people felt that way. There was a real difficulty among most black people, especially in the North, to really think to themselves, I will let these people put hose me down with water or whatever. No, the immediate reaction is on a day-to-day basis, the idea is to defend yourself at all costs, because you're so confronted all the time with violence anyway, that the idea that you would accept violence nonviolently was just literally not part of our thinking. And it certainly wasn't a part of my thinking.
My guest is Elaine Brown. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Elaine Brown is my guest, former head of the Black Panther Party and author of a new memoir called A Taste of Power. Now, you say you saw feminism as a white girl's thing.
We all did. We all said that anyway. Secretly, we didn't know, but openly, because we would be abandoning our brothers, we felt. And so, therefore, it was something for white people to discuss. But we black women, we were with our men. And as I even say, I remember on a wall in Chicago, I saw this all over Chicago, men must change or die. And I thought that was just, you know, that was just like the ultimate either or problem or solution kind of thing. It was actually very funny to me. But we decided, we black women, especially those of us as part of any kind of progressive movement, decided that we would be abandoning our duty if we even spoke about our rights as independent from the rights of our brothers, even though our brothers were at the time speaking about claiming their black manhood, and the word womanhood was sort of subsumed or presumed in there, but actually we found that it wasn't so much in there, but it was very clearly our black manhood was a key, pardon me, phrase within the Black Power movement. So our notion was that we would be abandoning our brothers if we separated ourselves out, and that this was an issue white women had the luxury to discuss, that we were in emergency and we had to do emergency tactics by joining together.
Did your feelings change at that during your stay in the Panthers or afterwards?
Well, certainly my feelings have changed a lot since then, but during the time that I was in the party, bit by bit I began to open my eyes, or my eyes began to be opened, that this was not an issue to be dismissed into the, well, we'll deal with that after the revolution is over, a sister world, because that was usually the other response. Yes, it's true that, you know, there is a disparity between men and women, but this is for after the revolution, meaning this is truly a secondary issue. When we have really, when we are really free, we will argue these cultural points, and that was how we all thought of it. Only when I was in the leadership of the party and there was no authority over me, there was no government, no person that could claim authority over me, because I was not only the absolute leader of the Black Panther Party, but I was a person who could direct the Black Panther Party to do this or that. And so there was no one to look to. And when I came into that position and I realized that I was a person unto myself and I had a taste of power, and then I began to realize what was happening to me now only because I was a woman, and I became very, very angry about it.
Give us an example of one of the things that happened to you because you were a woman.
There were the general things within the party, as I said, a brother saying to me, well, we can't call them the B word anymore, and that sort of thing. Later, when I had to fill certain gaps in the party leadership in terms of certain administrative roles, I put women in those positions, or I put people that I thought were the best. And they turned out to be women. And so I started getting a lot of feedback and a lot of grumbling about, you know, what are these women doing taking over our party? And so it became clearer and clearer to me that most of the people thought of a member of the Black Panther Party as a man, as opposed to as a comrade, as we all referred to ourselves. And finally, or not finally, but one of the nodal points, or one of the points that really triggered my consciousness, was when I was running for office for city council in Oakland, and there was another man running, a black man, and he began to assail me as a lesbian because he said I had put so many women, and he said the people knew that I really liked women. And I started really thinking, why was he saying this? And what, you know, were people saying this? And I really became personally tortured by this. And suddenly it occurred to me that the whole thing had to do with, as I indicate, valuing women and valuing myself, ultimately.
The Panthers were an armed revolutionary movement. Were you comfortable with guns? Did you learn how to use a gun when you were with the Panthers?
Well, I had a gun all the time. I did learn from the party. I said I didn't learn anywhere else. I wasn't in the Army or anything. And where else are you going to learn how to shoot a gun? I wasn't, excuse me, I had no access to guns before the party. And no, I wasn't afraid of the guns, because these guns, in my mind, were an instrument of resistance and perhaps deliverance. Not these particular guns, because we imagined that if there had to be armed struggle. But the guns that were in the hands of party members, these people were my friends. So, I mean, it's like having Officer Friendly come down if you when you think, well, this man has a gun, but this is not, what is this? I mean, you see guns everywhere in America. This is a violent country. All the police are armed and double armed. All the federal government officers, I mean, there are just guns in the American scene. But those guns make me nervous, because those guns are not serving any interests of mine, and certainly not protecting any interest and protecting me. And these guns were exactly the opposite. They were guns in the hands of my friends that might keep us from all being killed.
Were you ready to die for the cause?
I really thought that I was. I mean, no one is necessarily looking forward to death, but truly there was a moment at which, when you realize that what you believe you are doing is so significant that the fear of death is overwhelmed by the idea that perhaps your death will be meaningful.
What was it like to be a mother in this kind of armed, violent atmosphere?
Well, the atmosphere wasn't so armed and violent. We knew we had guns, but, I mean, these guns weren't, people weren't wearing guns every day. I mean, it was just, we were ordinary people. We had eventually, I should say, we developed our school for our children. Because when we started in the party, we were all very young, and most of us, with the exception of people like David Hilliard, didn't have children. We didn't come to the party all packaged up as parents and everything, and then taking our whole families with us. Most of us came in individually and very young. And then we began to have children, and then we began to figure out what are we going to do with these children. So we created a school. We created first daycare centers and childcare centers. And as our children got older, we realized they could not, and we did not want them to go to the public schools. So our children knew very, they lived in an extraordinarily protective space. So I don't think half of them had any idea in their childhood. They knew what the Black Panther Party was, but they didn't have to be confronted in any way with anything that smacked of danger or violence. As a matter of fact, we did everything we could to keep them over on the side and away from harm.
Why did you leave the Panthers? When did you leave? Why did you leave?
I left in the end of 1977, and I left the incident that triggered my leaving was that one of the women in the party had been beaten up very severely by some men in the party. And she had been one of the hardest workers in the party. And I wouldn't have even known about it, which tells me something, but I wouldn't have even known about it if another woman hadn't called. So now not only am I not the person in authority when Huey Newton had come back, but women are now again being beaten and with authority. And this was incredible to me, especially given that so many of the brothers had become so completely out of control after Huey got back, and they felt that they had gotten back their real leader and didn't have to be burdened with me anymore. And when I talked to Huey about it, he was very unconcerned, nonchalant about this beating, and this woman was hospitalized with her jaw broken. And I said, what is happening here? You know, there's some disparity or division between the men and the women. And he said, and what's your point? You're fine. What do you care? And that was when I knew I had to leave because I saw the handwriting on the wall.
And this was what year?
1977.
Your book ends there. And yeah. I have no idea what you've been doing since then. How have you made a living? What have you done with your life?
It's been very hit and miss. In the beginning, directly after leaving the Black Panther Party, it was very difficult, obviously, to suddenly become not a Panther and decide, what, I'm going to become a corporate executive, and what am I going to do? I've just been committed my entire life to revolutionary change, and now I'll just take a job somewhere and settle into my life, and that'll be the end of that. So I could not do that, and I was very unhappy, and I was always unhappy to be alive. And what I did, I got a job from Suzanne DePass, my friend. She took care of me, essentially, for 2 years. And then I worked at a variety of jobs, and I went to law school, and I floundered around. I was really just sort of going from pillar to post in order to survive, and until it occurred to me that my daughter was still suffering because I was completely crazy in the manner that I was living, and I decided to go to therapy and start over again, which I did.
Eileen Brown, thank you very much for talking with us. I wish we had more time to talk.
Oh, thank you very much. I appreciate being here. Really, I do.
Eileen Brown's new memoir is called A Taste of Power. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Deaconess Hospital in Boston has one of the few programs in the country that combines research on AIDS with treatment of AIDS patients. Coming up, we meet the director of the program, Dr. Jerome Groopman. He's been researching new drugs and caring for people with AIDS since the start of the epidemic. Also, TV critic David Bianculli previews the new cop show, Homicide. It's directed by Barry Levinson, who's best known for directing such films as Rain Man and Good Morning Vietnam. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Clinton has delayed giving his announcement that would start phasing in an end to a ban on gays in the military. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
President Clinton said he favors a delay in lifting the ban so that the military could have 6 months to work on implementing the change. The basic principle, Mr. Clinton said, is whether people willing to conform to a military code of conduct should be allowed to serve. The White House and Democrats in Congress are still working on a two-step approach. First, the military would be instructed to stop asking recruits about their sexual preference. Then, hearings and consultations would be held for about 6 months. During that time, a code of conduct for gays would be developed. It would describe how open homosexuals in the military could be about their sexual orientation. The chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, Sam Nunn, and several military leaders have suggested they would support lifting the ban on allowing gays to serve if gays were prohibited from openly declaring their homosexuality once they were in the armed forces. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
Officials at the State Department have called on the UN Security Council to delay consideration of sanctions against Israel for expelling more than 400 Palestinians. U.S. officials say that diplomatic efforts are better than a stormy debate in the U.N. Israel's highest court has upheld last month's government action, a move that has prompted Arab states to threaten to pull out of Middle Eastern peace talks. Officials of the Clinton administration have been trying to get the peace talks started again. After a ruling by Israel's highest court that a government order expelling some 400 Palestinians was legal, those expelled say that they have always maintained, under international law, it was not legal. Those now living in a so-called no-man's land in southern Lebanon say their view is supported in part by UN Resolution 799. Gerald Budd of the BBC reports.
The view of the deportees is that a clear decision from the Israeli court declaring the expulsions illegal and ordering the government to allow the Palestinians back across the border would have been significant. The judgment would have been totally in line with the conditions laid out in UN Resolution 799, which the Israeli government has refused to accept. Any other ruling from the judges was bound to be unacceptable to the deportees because it would automatically mean a compromise with the principles contained in the Security Council resolution. Therefore, it's highly unlikely that any of the 396 deportees will take up Mr. Rabin's offer of sending a written appeal against his expulsion order. To make a move of this kind, the Palestinians say, would be tantamount to accepting the legitimacy of Israel's expulsion policies.
Gerald Budd of the BBC. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up nearly 15 points to close at 3,306.25 on volume of more than 256 million shares. This is NPR News. In Croatia, fighting between Serbian and Croatian factions spread today to a major hydroelectric dam, forcing UN peacekeepers to move out of the area. UN officials are concerned that the violence may grow and call the danger intense. The dam itself provides power and water to most of the coastal area and has been under UN control for more than 4 months now. A Red Cross convoy heading for Bosnia was forced to turn around for security reasons. UN officials have been warned that the dam has been planted with explosives. According to a new Census Bureau report, the number of women in executive positions nearly doubled during the 1980s. NPR's Phyllis Crockett reports.
The doubling of the number of women executives came during a time when there was only a 2 percentage point increase in the proportion of women in the workforce, from 43% to 45%. The Census Bureau says the number of women in executive, administrative, and managerial positions is up 95% over the previous decade. The number of women in farming, forestry, and fishing jobs rose by 12%, and the number of women in precision production, craft, and repair occupations grew by 26%. The report examines shifts in occupations held by the nation's workforce in 1990 compared to a similar report based on the 1980 census. It looked at more than 500 job categories by sex and ethnic group. I'm Phyllis Crockett in Washington.
And the federal government says that the U.S. economy grew at its quickest pace in 4 years in the fourth quarter of last year. The Commerce Department says that the nation's gross domestic product expanded by 3.8% in the fourth quarter of 1992, helped by the strongest holiday selling season in years. Business inventories also grew less slowly in the fourth quarter. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Since the beginning of the AIDS epidemic, my guest, Dr. Jerome Groopman, has been treating people with AIDS and researching new therapies. He heads an innovative program at the New England Deaconess Hospital in Boston, which combines the research of new drugs with the care of AIDS patients. The program delivers care to over 1,000 people. 53 scientists are researching the virus and all aspects of HIV-related infection. The controversial artist Robert Mapplethorpe was one of Dr. Groopman's patients. The Mapplethorpe Foundation donated $300,000 to expand the program's laboratory. I asked Dr. Groopman why his clinic combines research and patient care, which are usually separate.
Our belief was that this fusion of the two worlds, of the clinic, the bedside, and the laboratory bench, really resulted in both better care for the patients, the ability to translate discoveries in the laboratory more rapidly into clinical programs, and also by observing an evolving disease like AIDS, one could take information from the bedside and bring it back into the laboratory and hopefully accelerate discovery there.
What are you testing now?
We're testing several programs. We're one of the lead centers in what's called active vaccination, that is, people who have recently become infected with HIV and whose immune systems still appear intact. We're trying to boost their own immune response against the virus by vaccinating them with genetically engineered components of the virus.
Let me just stop you. That gets down to the very kind of root problem of AIDS, which is the immune system. The immune system breaks down and leaves someone with AIDS vulnerable to every kind of infection.
Right. There are different ways of approaching it depending upon where someone is in the course of HIV infection. Very early on, as you know, there's a relatively long period of many months to several years where the immune system is still relatively intact. It's at that point that this particular program seeks to intervene to augment immune function and keep people there. There are also clearly people who have lost a great deal of immune function, usually reflected in a loss of so-called helper T cells. And then when that happens, there's really a different strategy that's applied. One is to try to limit the replication of the virus, and it appears that the virus is quite actively replicating in people with relatively advanced disease, and also to prevent the so-called opportunistic infections, the pneumonia, the encephalitis, and the other problems, the infectious problems that people with severe immune deficiency encounter. The key in people who have lost a large number of T cells, or the goal, is to try to determine how to reconstitute their immune system. And that goal has been relatively elusive to date.
And T cells are a measure of your immunity.
Yeah, they're a rough estimate of your immune function. Most people who are not infected have helper T cell numbers between about 550 and 1,200. People with very advanced HIV disease might have T cell numbers less than 50, so one-tenth of to 1/20th of where they would start.
So what else are you working on now? What else are you testing?
Well, we're working on another program called TAT, T-A-T. This is a very interesting new blocker of HIV that works through a mechanism completely different than the well-known drugs, AZT, DDI, DDC. This is a drug that blocks the expression, or what's called the transcription, of the virus. AZT works very early in the life cycle of the virus, after the virus first enters the target cell, and partially blocks the virus from making a copy of itself. Clearly, people have been infected with the virus long before they were ever given AZT, so that copies of the virus have been made within their cells and actually integrate within their own nuclei, within the center of the cell, within their own chromosomes. The TAT inhibitor in the test tube is able to suppress the viral components that have integrated into the person's chromosomes from being expressed and then from forming new infectious viral particles. So this is particularly interesting to us because it, as I said, has a mechanism of action which is quite distinct from AZT and would presumably work well in cells that have already been infected and not simply protect virgin cells.
When you're working with people who have HIV and you're testing new drugs on them, how do you talk with them so that you keep up their hope but don't get their hopes up too high about the drug that you're testing?
Well, I think it's very important to be hopeful and to be optimistic. I've been involved really since 1980 in AIDS when I was at the University of California and the very first people were seen. So I have a perspective of more than a decade now. And there really is progress that has been made, and I believe there's tremendous progress that will be made in terms of new treatments. And I think that's important to communicate. On the other hand, many times things can look very promising in a test tube and fail to be effective clinically. So it's a very difficult process, and I think you need to both present in detailed and clear terms the rationale, the scientific rationale for a new experimental treatment, why you think that particular person may be, benefit from it, but also have the distance and the critical approach to discuss with the person why the drug potentially might not work and also what the toxicities could be, and then try in a partnership sense to make an informed decision together and go ahead with the experimental trial or not.
Dr. Jerome Groopman is my guest. Time for a short break. This is Fresh Air. Just joining us, my guest is Dr. Jerome Groopman. He's chief of hematology and oncology at Deaconess Hospital in Boston, where he runs an AIDS research and treatment program. He's also a professor of immunology at Harvard. What has made you most hopeful, and what has made you most pessimistic in your years of AIDS research?
What's made me most hopeful has been, as opposed to many life-threatening and diseases like many cancers, where the cause is not identified and the basic biochemical and molecular mechanisms involved are still quite vague. In the case of HIV, we know what is the primary cause of the immune deficiency, and we know the genetic structure of the virus, so that we have a number of very attractive targets against which drugs can be developed. The first blush was AZT, DDI, and so on, which was against an enzyme of the virus, reverse transcriptase. And now, as I said, the TAT blocker, and there's something called a protease inhibitor, which is against another enzyme of the virus. So this is very helpful. And putting those drugs together, drugs which have different mechanisms of action, my hope is that one can control the replication of the virus and prevent it from damaging the immune system and keep people in a relatively stable state of health for decades. What I think is the most frustrating and the most difficult are two things. One is the capacity of this virus to elude and mutate in response to these blockers. So this is a very diabolical and very difficult opponent in a way to sort of grab hold of and keep one's hold on. And the second is that people with very advanced HIV disease whose immune function is quite low have an evolving set of problems, most dramatically cancers such as lymphoma, which are very, very hard to treat.
How close do you let yourself come to your patients?
Well, I think you should get close to your patients.
That's funny because, you know, the thing you always hear is that you can't let yourself get too close to your patients because you'll get too emotionally involved and you'll just burn out.
Well, there is a high rate of burnout. I think you can't lose it, so to speak. I mean, you can't become so emotionally involved that you can't function in terms of making recommendations and helping in decisions and being analytical in terms of trying to make a diagnosis when there's an unclear problem. On the other hand, I think most of the people that I care for are young, in tremendous need, and quite attractive people in terms of their lives. And I think if you maintain a sort of cool emotional distance, it's not optimally therapeutic, to put it in that terms, and it's also just not the way I would want to be cared for if I were on the other side of the the examining table, if I were the patient and not the the physician. So I think burnout, though, is difficult to avoid in some way. I've avoided it.
How have you avoided it?
I think in part that I have a very strong family and a very good marriage and active, wild kids that keep me busy. I swim a mile every day, which is a good way to decompress. I guess I'm able in some way to absorb a certain amount of suffering to a point that doesn't shatter me.
What have you learned from your patients about different ways in which people face death?
Well, I've seen incredible courage, I think it's most interesting, particularly early in the epidemic, when the social stereotypes of gay men from the 50s and 60s and so on, of being wimps and sissies and all of this, which is sort of the worst kind of images that they've been portrayed in movies and books and so on. I mean, here are people who had a courage and a dignity and a strength, an inner strength, which was and is unbelievable, of tremendous depth. And I think that has taught me a great deal about the resources that all people have in facing this. I think what's changed, though, in the epidemic and has made it even more difficult is that early in the epidemic, people who were very ill and were facing death did not have the sense that they were replaying images in their mind which were derived from seeing their friends in a similar situation. Right now, many of the people I take care of have had 10, 20, 30, 50 friends die of AIDS in the last decade. And they've been there at the bedside watching the weight loss and the vomiting and the encephalitis and the blindness and all the horrendous complications that can occur in the very advanced stages of AIDS. So that it's much more difficult having that concrete, immediate knowledge when you yourself are approaching that. And I think it's called for a greater degree of strength in people who are now facing it. And frankly, there are many patients who decide not to face it.
They decide to terminate their life.
Yeah, they decide to commit suicide in one form or another.
Do you worry about your own health a lot and about your own exposure to HIV? Do you get yourself tested often?
Early on, I worried quite a bit. In fact, I had an illness with fever and mild hepatitis in 1983, which with bronchitis, which really frightened me. And I thought I had AIDS, and there was no test for HIV at that time. Turned out I didn't have that. I had another infection. Currently, there's so much known about HIV per se that the delivering care to people is not a risk to me for HIV. What is a risk is tuberculosis, and this is a new problem which is of tremendous dimensions in the world and a real threat to healthcare providers and essentially to everyone because that is a communicable disease which is spread through the air. There are sort of two peaks and one valley of concern. There was an initial peak among physicians and nurses, healthcare providers, with regard to how is HIV spread. Then there's the valley of real comfort in knowing that we're really not at risk for HIV through caring for people in general. But now the emergence of tuberculosis has really changed the picture in terms of healthcare concerns for medical providers.
Dr. Jerome Groopman is the head of an AIDS program at the New England Deaconess Hospital in Boston, where he also heads the Hematology Oncology Division. He's also a professor of immunology at Harvard Medical School. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. As usual this week, we'll have the latest on the gays in the military story from the White House and the rest of the official Washington. Also, Andy Bowers on changes in the White House press operations. There have been some complaints there about lack of access in the Clinton administration. We'll discuss the issue of arms to Croatia, arms to Serbs fighting in Croatia and in Bosnia, and the lack of arms to the Bosnian government forces. The former Yugoslav republics are big customers for the weapons dealers, despite an arms embargo. Nina Totenberg reports on the memorial service today for Thurgood Marshall, former Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall. The funeral service was held at the National Cathedral.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. This Sunday, right after the Super Bowl, NBC is launching a new cop series. This one is called Homicide: Life on the Street, and it's the newest project by Barry Levinson, director of the films Diner, Rain Man, Good Morning Vietnam, and Avalon. TV critic David Bianculli has a review.
It's been 10 years since Barry Levinson tried to do a TV series. The last one was a sitcom version of Diner, which never got past the pilot stage at CBS, even though it showed a good eye for casting. James Spader and Paul Reiser were in that one, along with Robert Pastorelli, who's Eldon on Murphy Brown. Homicide has a strong cast, too. Ned Beatty, Yaphet Kotto, John Polito, Richard Belzer. Basically, a bunch of interesting character actors you never thought would wind up in the same show. But they have, and they've done it because this series, clearly, is all about character. Take Richard Belzer, the stand-up comic whose strong suit is sarcasm. He's acted on TV before, but mostly in toss-away camp roles like a reporter on the comic book series The Flash. Here, as a homicide detective with a definite attitude, he's been given the role of a career, certainly of his career. Even when he's interrogating a murder suspect, he throws insults and jokes at warp speed, like Lenny Bruce with a badge.
Who killed him?
A Jamaican killed him.
A Jamaican? What's his name?
I don't know, but he's the one that cut me, said he'd kill me too if I said anything.
When did they tell you that?
When he drove me to the hospital.
So this unnamed mystery Jake kills both Billard brothers, cuts your hand, drives you to Hopkins, bleeding all over his car, and swears you to secrecy along the way.
That's why I lied about the fence.
Okay, now I get it. You're saving your really good lives for some smarter cop, is that it? I'm just a donut in the on-deck circle. Wait till the real guy gets here. Wait till that big guy comes back. I'm probably just his secretary. I'm just Montel Williams. You want to talk to Larry King.
The cast also includes John Polito, who's familiar from all those Coen Brothers movies like Miller's Crossing and Barton Fink. His character is like Cliff Clavin with a badge. You know, the know-it-all postman from Cheers who spouts off about everything. In one scene, Polito's character is obsessed with a murder case, which would be okay, except it isn't exactly the one that he's been assigned to solve.
There were two people in the box with Lincoln the night he was shot. There was John Wilkes Booth, and there was a Major Henry Rathbone. How come we don't hear about this Henry Rathbone?
So you think Major Henry...
But the show isn't all laughs, not by any means. The obvious comparison for homicide is Hill Street Blues, where character was key, cases weren't always solved in an hour, and the squad room, the dialogue, and even the camera work were intentionally sloppy. Levinson, who directed this pilot episode, pushes the envelope just a bit more, shooting the whole thing with handheld cameras. This makes it look a little like a reality show, like the series Cops. But Levinson isn't the first film director to shoot fictional TV this way. Robert Altman did it 5 years ago, in HBO's Tanner 88. And besides the book Homicide by David Simon, on which this series is based, Levinson owes one other debt, to the dense, tense structure of St. Elsewhere. Tom Fontana, one of the producers on that show, is Levinson's partner in this venture, which explains a lot about why Homicide works so well so quickly. Speaking of Homicide in the same breath as Hill Street and St. Elsewhere, and even Tanner 88, is putting it up there with TV's very best. If future episodes live up to the pilot, Homicide will belong there. The Super Bowl championship is up for grabs this weekend, but afterward, NBC has a winner on its hands.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Post and author of Teleliteracy, Taking Television Seriously. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Joan Tui, with Sue Weinstein. Research assistance from Penny Nelson. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the problems faced by the Red Cross in the former Yugoslavia. Jette Sorensen of the International Committee for the Red Cross will speak with us from Zagreb, Croatia. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.